is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And can I just take a moment to celebrate?
Yes! All right! Yeah.
These days, I'm feeling downright hopeful. This weekend, I went to the grocery store. I mean to the actual store. Inside of it. For Memorial Day, my fully vaccinated family came together. We sat on the porch, ate barbecue, and at the end of the evening, we hugged each other. Aww. It was exactly the sort of normalcy President Joe Biden mentioned in his speech at the White House on Wednesday.
The more people we get vaccinated, the more success we're going to have in our fight against this virus.
Now, the speech is part of the administration's effort to increase vaccination enthusiasm and hit the target of 70% of American adults with at least one dose of vaccine by the 4th of July.
A summer of freedom, a summer of joy, a summer of get-togethers and celebrations, an all-American summer that this country deserves after a long, long dark winter that we've all endured.
On Tuesday, the White House invited community groups to join a Vaccination Month of Action. The president is touting public-private partnerships, offering incentives like event tickets and cash prizes. And in West Virginia, residents can even win guns for getting vaccinated. Yup, bear arms can help you bear arms. But no incentive is more powerful than the vision of
a summer of freedom.
And the vaccination push is urgent. Because as good as it feels to begin gathering again, our national journey through the COVID crisis is not at an end.
This is Ken from Pittsburgh. My employer of 42 years caught COVID 3 weeks ago, about 1 or 2 days before he got his second shot. He had no symptoms for 1 week. He had symptoms that got progressively worse for a week, and then he went into the hospital. The next day, the ICU, the next day after that, on a ventilator. 10 days later, he had pneumonia. 2 days after that, he passed away. We all wear our masks at this store, even now, and we've all been vaccinated twice. We continue to make the customers wear masks, too, and that will happen until 250 million Americans are vaccinated.
According to the New York Times tracker, 519 people died of the coronavirus on Monday. And each day, we inch closer to 600,000 lost lives in this country. Globally, the pandemic continues to ravage South America and batter parts of Africa and Asia, including Japan, where athletes from all over the world have already begun to arrive for the Olympic Games. Athletes who will live and mingle and compete for weeks and then return home to nations throughout the world. And here in the U.S., who is continuing to shoulder the burden of the pandemic even as the national picture improves? Well, it looks a lot like it did early on. In the city of Washington, D.C., it's overwhelmingly falling on Black residents. They make up around 80% of current COVID cases, despite being just 46% of the overall population. And according to the Washington Post, states including Kentucky and Tennessee are starting to see similar racial disparities among current infections. And for more on this, I'm now joined by Dr. Deborah Furholden, who is Associate Dean for Public Health Integration and Director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions at Michigan State University. Dr. Furholden, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. This is a great conversation.
And also with us is S. Mitra Kalita, publisher of Epicenter, a newsletter for New Yorkers to get through the pandemic. She's also CEO of URL Media, a network of Black and Brown community news outlets. Mitra, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Deborah, I want to start with you. In mid-May, you told the news outlet Bridge Michigan that, quote, the virus is still wreaking havoc in the community. Is that still the case today for Black and Brown residents of Michigan?
The numbers have gotten slightly better in Michigan. We were in the height of a surge at that point. But we still have tremendous racial disparities that exist in COVID deaths. In some communities, we have disparities in COVID cases. And more importantly, we have tremendous disparities in who's actually getting the shots in the arms. So I keep telling people, we're just not out of the woods yet. You know, this is not the time to take our foot off the gas. This is the time to stay the course. So it's better, but we still are dealing with real problems with getting this pandemic under control.
Mitra, how about you, based here in Queens, New York? How significant do the racial disparities look to you?
They feel fairly significant, and unfortunately, that has been the story throughout the vaccine rollout. So I would agree with Dr. Folden that it's looking better, but at least here in Queens, the least vaccinated group remain Black residents of Queens. I believe only 21% of them have gotten one dose, and you can compare that to the rest of New York City, which is well over half have received one dose. And so that is a hill to climb, right? And there's a number of reasons for that. But, I do feel like there are some lessons we've seen and learned in January, and we're already in June, and I still feel like they're not quite getting through on the vaccine rollout.
Okay, so let's pause right there, because that's where I want to dig in. When we look at a disparity, right, at an inequity in a number, that's just sort of a fact or a data point. But it's really the meaning behind it, the causes that that are the public health question, right? The what do we do about it? So, Dr. Verhulden, let me come to you on that. If we're looking at disparate rates of infection and disparate rates of vaccination, is that because of personal behavior? Is that because of vaccine reluctance? Is it an access question? What is going on?
So earlier in the pandemic, we pointed to the same old usual suspects. We said, oh, African Americans have more pre-existing health conditions, and they were sicker going into the pandemic, and that's why they're doing worse with these COVID-related illnesses. And it turns out that just wasn't the case. In fact, many of the factors that were driving both the increased likelihood for Black and brown people of becoming cases and also dying if they contracted COVID were things that were outside of their control. That shelter in place order, the stay home, the ability to switch your work over to, you know, some online platform where you could do it from your living room. A lot of people simply didn't have that luxury. The gap in the inequality that we see in wages and employment and then the types of occupations that people hold, that showed up in the pandemic. And we found out that a lot of the excess exposure that we saw in Black and brown and other underserved communities was not related anything to the actions or behaviors or the will of the individual. In fact, it was related to these larger macro social and political determinants of health. The fact that Black and brown people are overrepresented in high demand, low wage jobs. Those physicians weren't providing PPE and basics like face masks and paid time off for people. And we're seeing the exact same thing happening with vaccinations. I know so many people who've said, I'd be willing to get the vaccine, but could I get a paid day off? My colleagues who got the vaccine got sick. And I don't want to care for patients, or I don't want to have to deliver food, or I don't want to have to stand at the checkout line checking people out if I'm sick, if I have a fever, or if I'm not feeling well. So we're just lacking a lot of a real truth telling about some of these larger societal factors that really make our world quite inequitable and unfair for people based on things like race, where you live, how much money you make, in those types of factors. So we learned that early in the pandemic, and we have to do a better job of bringing those lessons forward in this vaccine rollout strategy.
I so appreciate that point. Even as we were kind of thinking about the intro, I was like, I really was hyped to go to the grocery store, but I also acknowledge, right, the very real privilege associated with the fact that I not only haven't had to go to the grocery store, I haven't had to work in the grocery store, which is, of course, the reality for so many Black and brown communities, right? It's not just can you go, it's that is your job, and you are in this close contact with folks at every point. Mitra, I want to talk to you a little bit about that vaccine access question as well. Again, if we go to Dr. Verhulden's point about kind of the old narratives that showed up, like, oh, well, you know, Black folks aren't going to get the vaccine because Tuskegee. I mean, I don't want to argue that that isn't some part of it, but what are you hearing about access relative to vaccines?
So I don't think we have to go as far back as Tuskegee to understand the mistrust in the system. And, you know, it is a present day reality for Black and brown people. That can mean, you know, somebody saying they have symptoms of COVID and not being treated seriously by their doctor. It might mean an issue of documentation or access, right? So I think it's just important to understand the factors that create mistrust and friction in the system and actually don't even allow a large portion of our population to interact with the healthcare system. So that was, you know, I've been a journalist for more than two decades, and I felt somewhat naive because Epicenter, our organization, started helping people get booked for the vaccines. And if you think about a lot of the narratives we just take for granted, it's like, oh, if you have allergies or if you're pregnant or if you have this condition, ask your doctor. Well, many of our people don't even have a doctor, right? So
I was like, that's assuming you have one. That's right.
There's so many assumptions. But like, think about even you know, Dr. Verhulden's point on the conditions under which we're working, terms like social distancing and quarantine, which, you know, my assumption, again, all of us on this call are, you know, those are terms that we get. And they're terms, at least here in the Epicenter, which is the neighborhoods of Jackson Heights, Corona, Elmhurst, and Queens, that were so hard hit by COVID. For many people in their apartments, it's absolutely impossible to social distance. And so if you get COVID, if the CDC puts out guidance saying, you know, you can unmask now, you know, you got to look around in some of these blended households and say, well, some of us have our vaccines. Some of us work in grocery stores. You know, some of us don't, you know, share one bedroom, multiple people. Like, is this one size fits all, no mask policy going to work for our communities? And I think the answer is no.
So, Dr. Verhulden, let me come to you on this. On Wednesday, President Biden announced some initiatives to get more people vaccinated this month, including a partnership with Black barbershops. That, along with what you were talking about in terms of potentially a day off. It's funny. It sounds to me an awful lot, like what it also takes to get people to vote, right? That you need a little bit of room, a little bit of access, some information from trusted sources.
I cannot underscore enough during this time the value of the trusted, credible messenger. Most people are getting their information from social media, from news media, and word of mouth. And so for the people who are those trusted, credible messengers in community, they are already doing the work. Barbers and friends and family and the local federally qualified health centers and local trusted leaders are already doing all that they can to boost COVID literacy and boost vaccine confidence in communities. I love this approach of better resourcing those partners, those trusted messengers who have more credibility with the people who are on the fence than somebody like myself or even a national spokesperson could ever have. So we do need to have more grassroots, ground up efforts and resource communities to do that work.
Mitra, I want to talk to you a little bit about another form of access here, and that has to do with where one can get a vaccine. Talk to me about the subway stations.
So I think one of the best things, this is good news on the government's part, a few weeks ago, they really started to make a push to not just have vaccine megasites as the place to get your vaccine, but really push into communities through mobile vans and even the New York City subway system. It's been wildly popular because to the points we've been making of people who are working, you know, two, maybe three jobs, they might not have time to get to a vaccine clinic or their doctor's office or a mega site. But if they're commuting, the vaccine's offered in the, you know, in the subway system. And sure enough, you know, that has been a wildly successful program. Similarly, here in Jackson Heights, there have been these mobile units in popular business districts and where restaurant workers gather. And those, you know, as soon as they brought the vaccines into neighborhoods, you saw an uptick and you saw, you know, and it wasn't really rocket science. It was, of course, you got to decentralize, you know, to the doctor's point, you got to decentralize and get the shots to the places where people are, but also delivered and information given by people whom they trust.
There's another set of lessons that I feel like we've learned in public health when there are these kinds of racial health disparities over time. And one is that once it gets kind of stuck, if you end up with high levels of vaccination and COVID kind of goes away for folks with resources and for predominantly white communities, sometimes we can lose political incentive to address infectious disease once it is perceived and experienced as a Black and brown disease. Dr. Verholden, is that possible with COVID?
It is. And I think what it underscores is we've learned a lot during COVID. I always say COVID didn't create these problems. What it did is it shined a light, and it gave us an opportunity to have a real honest reckoning with the truth about how unfair and inequitable our society really is. And there's a real business case to be made for equity. This pandemic will have cost us more than $2 trillion to resolve. And that's if things continue on the path that they're on and we actually come out on the other side before the end of the year. You know, there's a real cost to inequity in our society. There's a cost to human capital and the loss of life. There's a real financial cost. And I think the problem is that by design, our society didn't have equity baked in. Our society was built and constructed without equity baked into it. So now the question is, how do we do that? How do we have it be that what we learned in COVID doesn't end in COVID, but rather we start to re-envision and reimagine and re-engineer our society and our healthcare system so that equity is now baked into it? And I do think that we can do that. And it's going to require a few things. It's going to require legislative action. It's going to require enforcement. And we need real incentives for equity and disincentives for inequity.
Early on, I know our family was sustaining so many losses, especially with our family in New Orleans, but it did feel as though we were all in it together. But for friends and family members who are now beginning to lose folks, even as we're coming out of it, they seem to be feeling much more isolated in that experience of illness and loss. Have you been hearing from people on this? And what are the resources for providing some support?
I think the United States is in this really privileged position where we don't have a vaccine shortage. We are so blessed that there are no issues of supply in this country. And so what I would say is that, to your point of being in it together, you know, we started out the pandemic with that sensibility, and now we're starting to see somewhat of a fracture between who, even in the US, you know, if this is going to be a Black and brown disease, are we going to prioritize it in the same way that we do other illnesses, as well as the seriousness with which we treated COVID a year ago? And I also think it's important to continue the sentiment of being one world, that our brothers and sisters in Brazil and India and Peru and some of the places that you've mentioned don't have access to vaccine, but we are a connected world. And so between some of the conditions that are more dense in terms of housing and the jobs that we've talked about today, the reality of who is not getting vaccinated or access to vaccines in the US, and then these very scary variants of potentially from overseas or people migrating to and fro, you know that we are one world, and I really do hope that we act that way in order to get to the other side.
S. Mitra Kalita is the publisher of the newsletter Epicenter and CEO of URL Media. And Dr. Deborah Verholden is the director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions at Michigan State University. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing this conversation forward.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to be here.